set?
Yep.
Okay. Senator Frederickson laughed again.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, good afternoon, members and guests. I think we'll go ahead and get started here. I guess I got my initiation to power storage technology at a workshop that I went to out west in the middle of last year, and I met Dr. Yuk there. And, I thought that, it was information that we needed to have more of the members hear about. Just for your information, one of the handouts lists this as a meeting of the full committee. This is a meeting of the Energy Finance Subdivision, not the entire division. So with that, I think we'll call on our guests and let them introduce themselves. For the tape, if you would just state your name when you give your before you give your presentation and where you're from and who you're representing, that would be helpful.
Second. Well, I am Imre Diuk. Doesn't matter how you pronounce it. I answer to all kinds of things. And I'm the program manager for energy storage at the Department of Energy. Have been doing that for the last 10 years or so.
And that's the U.S. Department of Energy.
That's the U.S. Department of Energy. And I am very pleased to have been invited by Senator Kubli to Minnesota. And by coincidence, this is actually not the first time I have been involved with energy storage in Minnesota. Many years ago, I used to run the program on thermal energy storage. And we used to do things like inject hot water into the ground and then bring it back in winter for district heating and so on. And I did this with the the University of Minnesota and the U.S. Geological Survey. And I also had a project up in Ely, Minnesota, which involved using the warm water, relatively warm waters down in a mine, and using them as a heat pump year-round. And in those days, I used to work closely with Congressman Oberstar, who was interested in these technologies. And, he'd speak up for funding every year. And we did this until Congress and the Department of Energy pulled the rug from under us and decided that we really weren't interested in that sort of technology. And now, 10 years later, thermal storage is a common, widespread technology in the Scandinavian countries, and it's not really done here. So, however, I understand that in Ely, they are thinking of perhaps reviving that project, and so maybe there will be a thermal storage project in Ely, which I would welcome very much because it's a wonderful place to go to for canoeing and hiking, which I have enjoyed very much there. Well, but now I'm going to talk about electrical energy storage. Which way does it go forward? There we are. Okay. So what is energy storage? Energy storage provides energy when it is needed just as transmission provides energy where it is needed. Transmission brings the energy from one place to the other. Energy storage brings it from one time to the other. Now, why should that be an interesting thing? Well, the reason is because the load is naturally variable. You know, as human beings, we have a biological rhythm. So the result is that during daytime, mostly, we consume a lot of electricity. At night, much less so. So the load is by its very nature variable. As we bring renewables into the picture, the generation is variable too. And storage can be the thing that mediates and links this variable load with the variable generation. Now, before I go on, I should say something about the domains of power involved in this. Because you can say, well, you know, there are batteries, why should we worry? You know, we have batteries all over the place, from our PC to our iPod to, well, virtually anything. However, there is a vast difference in the amount of power. And on that scale, we go up by factors of 100. And as you can see, the power involved in a utility application is many hundreds of times larger than what we have in consumer products. And as a result, the same technologies that work well in the consumer product do not necessarily work as well when you bring it to the high power end. And new, different technologies, different kinds of batteries, different kinds of mechanisms might well be applicable up there that you're not used to for the small power. So, a little excursion on what drives the modern grid. The point is, the modern grid, as everything else, is involved in considerable change. Okay, things are really quite different from the way they were, let's say, 40 years ago. Okay? There's a lot of things that have happened. And three of these drivers, if you wish, I have outlined here four, actually. One is the digitization of society. We've become a digital society. And what this means is we need a lot more power quality than we used to have. When you have an analog device, if the power changes a little bit, the voltage changes or whatever it is, no big deal. But when you have a digital device, it's very easy for such a device to... It takes only a very small change, an outage of a few cycles, and the whole thing conks out because they are very sensitive to power quality. Another one is ecological concern. I think over the last 30 years or so, we have all become much more ecologically concerned, whether that's pollution in general or whether it's thermal storage or many other ecological aspects. I think we are much more involved and we expect our electricity industry, just as everything else, to be ecologically viable and eventually sustainable. Another one, of course, and that looms over all of us, is the growth in energy consumption. We've been consuming more and more energy, and not just us, but the whole world. And it's due to two things. It's due, first of all, to population growth, and then it is due to the fact that we are relying more and more on modern conveniences. So even on a per capita basis, we use a lot more electricity than we used to. And every year, more so. The result is that energy consumption goes up and up and up, and that presses, puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the grid, the electric grid. And to keep it stable, it will need special efforts. And then, of course, there's security. I'd rather not talk about this. It's kind of pleasant to be in a building where I didn't have to go through several guards and be frisked. It's enjoyable. Glad, but I hope you keep it that way. In Washington, it's impossible. You can't even go into an office building without having to go through machinery.
Yeah, I think, Senator Fredrickson had a question, but I think you know, we have a preference for doing the presentations and taking questions and discussion at the end. Can it wait, or do you have something that you...
Mr. Chairman, I would like just a quick definition. What do you mean by dispatchable?
Okay.
Dispatchable means that we can have the energy when we want it.
Both when and where, I assume.
Right.
Thank you, Doctor.
So, security, of course, is there too, and it's becoming a real concern. Storage can contribute to the solution of all of these issues to some degree, and I will sort of take them roughly one by one. First of all, what kind of technologies do we have available for storing things? First of all, we have up in the upper right-hand corner, we have big and well-developed technologies. Pumped hydro, first of all. Spain, for example, has something like 20% pumped hydro. That means on peak, off peak, they pump the water up into a reservoir. On peak, they just let it run down and develop hydroelectricity. They've got 20%. They have nothing to worry about stability. In the U.S., it's about 2%. It's one of the lowest amounts of storage of any of the countries. Japan, for example, is 15%. Europe generally has about 10%, roughly. The other one is compressed air energy storage, and I will talk a little bit about that later on. Then you have a whole suite, a whole portfolio of batteries and other energies. In the middle, you've got the traditional lead-acid batteries. We know that technology very well. It's a useful technology. It has served our cars very nicely, but it also has problems. Generally, in these applications, lasts only for 3 or 4 years. It needs service. It's perhaps not perfect. Then we have other batteries, like the sodium-sulfur battery up there, which has become very popular. We have lithium-ion batteries. We have flywheels. And we have something called superconducting magnetic energy storage, which is not very much used. But the Department of Energy supports all of these technologies to some degree. Flow batteries, I should mention. Vanadium redox batteries, zinc, bromine, and so on. By the way, I'm going to make this presentation available to the committee and anybody in the audience who needs it, so you don't have to scribble fast. In fact, we had planned to have it on the table, but I couldn't. I was trying to send it yesterday, but the Senate server doesn't accept 11 megabytes. Built to the what is it, acquisitions office or whatever. Anyway, so there's a lot of different batteries, and you know, there is no clear winner. There isn't a battery which is the solution, because different applications need different sort of technologies. For instance, you might want to sodium sulfur batteries work very nicely if you want to store 6 hours worth of batteries. If you want the power battery, and I will show you what it is, then other things like lithium ion and some of the others are preferable. Flywheels, for example. So, lots of technologies, and all of them could use further development, particularly making them cheaper, because in this world, the parameters that you're looking for to improve are price, price, and price. Okay? So, I'm going to take these one by one. I'm first going to talk about power quality, voltage, and voltage and frequency regulation. First, an example which I like because, first of all, it was done by a co-op up in Alaska, and it's world's most powerful battery, about 40 megawatts up in Fairbanks. The problem there is that all the power, all the generation is in Anchorage, and there is a long, long line all the way to Fairbanks. And because the line is so long, it gets weak at the end. You may have lines of that type in Minnesota too, where you have to send it to some fairly remote site, and the voltage doesn't always hold up in those areas. And indeed, they had lots of complaints because they had outages all the time. So they decided to solve that not by building generation there, but by putting this battery, which provides about, 15 minutes of power. And that's really all that's necessary. And it pays for itself. In 2006, they responded to 82 events and prevented 311,000 member outages. Over 3 or 4 years, the thing pays for itself. And it's an unbelievable thing, actually. It's a huge, long building, and it's totally clean and so on. This is important because it's not only the outback of Alaska. These outages are important everywhere. In the entire United States, the loss to industry from outages is about $79 billion. Now, the interesting thing is, that's billion dollars. I mean, that's substantial money. In fact, it's about one-third of the entire, the price of the entire electricity business. The interesting thing is that only one-third of those are the big outages. The other two-thirds are the little outages, which to us are just flickers. But if you are doing high-tech manufacturing, for example, those little flickers may put your entire plant out of commission. If you're doing polymer extrusion, for example, you've got a little brownout, or you've got an actual outage of a few cycles only. Everything stops. All the gunk congeals in the dyes. Takes you 8 hours to straighten everything out again. You lose an entire day's run. That's why these things are so expensive. And that's, of course, a prime application for storage devices. And that market, is well taken care of. But as we develop bigger and better batteries, it'll be taken care of even better. What is interesting from a utility point of view is what is called frequency regulation. The thing is that the load and the generation are always out of balance. Okay, the load goes up and the frequency has to go up too, but it takes a while to get there. Okay, and that's why you get continual variations. Now, if you look at it, the blue curve on there is the way the load rises on the average, but the frequency regulation is that little wiggle on top of it, and that wiggle is the reason why it's called frequency regulation is because instead of changing the voltage, they change the frequency. But the point is, you can't do this indefinitely. So the independent system operator, for instance, the Midwest independent system operator, or CalISO or New York ISO, that oversees a large area, essentially sends out a signal and tells participating utilities, generate a bit more, generate a bit less. Now, it turns out this is a very, very inefficient way of doing it, because it takes the generator, 5 minutes, 7 minutes, to catch up with that signal. If you did this by storage, in other words, if you took your stored power, you could almost instantaneously dump it on the grid and correct this fluctuation. So the current method of shifting load fluctuations is inefficient. Fast storage could do this much better because they can respond instantaneously. And one of these technologies is flywheels, for example. There are other technologies too, and I will mention them. Here is one of our projects. We do hands-on management. I actually show up in the factory and futz around among the technology there. Here's a flywheel being put together. Seven of those go into a trailer, and here's the finished trailer. And this was a project which we did as the very first project of its kind. We had one in California and one in New York State. And this was just 100 kilowatt. It worked wonderfully for 6 months. It followed the independent system operator command up and down and up and down. Now, For a place like California, at the moment, you need about 100 megawatt of regulation. I mean, this was just 100 kilowatt. Okay. So we sponsored, among other things, a design for a 20 megawatt facility with 100 kilowatt flywheels to be built in some state. Okay. So this is a technology which is going. And the reason why we want it, I've already indicated, because it can respond instantaneously. It's about twice effective as gas turbines and 20 times more effective than doing it with steam turbines. That's because during the time when it takes the fossil fuel generation to catch up, the demand may already be in the opposite way. You know, it goes up and down. For flywheels or other energy storage devices, this sort of in-out, in-out is a beautiful way to operate. They can do that easily. For a fossil fuel plant, to go up, down is inefficient because that's not an optimal way of operating a fossil fuel plant. And that's why regulation by fast storage is twice as effective, at least, than the other kind. It also represents a fantastic reduction in carbon dioxide emission and therefore greenhouse gases. It's about 70 to 80% over some of the other fossil fuel technologies. So it's more efficient, and it is environmentally much more acceptable. And it can be done cost effectively. So, I mean, it's a clear winner. In very recent days, we have... we should do another one. Yeah. This thing has been advancing quite quickly. Lithium-ion batteries have gotten into the fray too. Two companies, Altair Nano and A123. And here's an example of a 1 megawatt Altair Nano battery. A123 has the same sort of thing. Responds fast. Does exactly the same thing as flywheels. And here is a flywheel facility of 1 megawatt, which is sitting up in Massachusetts, and it's awaiting installation at a New York site. Now, so this works, it's more effective. In the same area, you can also play by demand reduction. If you have large industrial customers who have loads that can be interrupted, then you can do it with that too. Smart grid technology, you can do it even with individual customers. For example, a refrigerator doesn't mind if it's not running for a minute or so, whatever it is. So demand reduction can play there too. Another thing that we may be seeing in the future, if we have widespread introduction of plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, you could have your plug-in hybrid vehicle sitting in your garage, and it could receive a signal that tells it when it should charge. Now, this is not going back and forth, but it simply would delay charging a little bit, but since it's generally got a whole night anyway, it doesn't really matter. And this is an experiment down in, one of the North Carolina, one of those places, where they actually did this, and they showed that it works very well. But for the present, energy storage, be it by lithium-ion batteries, by ultracaps, or by flywheels, is a technology that I would expect to become reality in the very near future. What it needs, however, it needs a redesign of the tariff structure by the independent systems operator or the public utility. Because at the moment, the way the tariff is set up, it is obviously designed for fossil fuel generation and not for storage. Now, FERC are the people who regulate this whole thing on the federal level. FERC has already indicated that Public Utility Commissions and the ISOs ought to adjust their rules so that demand reduction and demand management and storage can play. It doesn't hurt anybody, It's just not quite business as usual. You've got to sit down and, for example, send the signal out more frequently on a few second basis rather than, a few minute basis. And this is happening as we are talking. MISO has just come out, Midwest Independent System Operator, has just come out with a new tariff structure, which is very suitable for storage. And the other ISOs are beginning to follow suit. So there's a lot more than just technology in there. You know, there's the whole acceptance of a new way of doing these things has to work through utility commissions, ISOs, state legislatures, and so on. I mean, people have to become ready and adjust things so that things like energy storage can play. Okay, now I'm going to a different subject. Peak shaving, energy management and upgrade deferral. In the previous example, we wanted power. We wanted a quick burst of energy for a few minutes, whatever it is. In this thing, we are playing a different game. The point is, when you look at the way the load generally behaves, there is a relatively small percentage of the time we are at or near peak load. Okay? A relatively small percentage of the time we are on a very low load. Now, wouldn't it be nice if we could take the electricity produced during that low load period and cover the peak load with it? And the point is, we can reduce the peak load by 25% by just providing 5% of storage. Because it goes up. It's like a hockey stick. So a little bit of storage can have a big effect on the overall situation. And that means that we don't have to design for this 100% level. It means our generation doesn't have to be as big. Our wires don't have to be as our transmission doesn't have to be as big. It means that our substations will have smaller loads. We are evening out this curve, and the more level that that asset utilization curve is, or the better for the efficiency, and the better it works economically. And I'll introduce one of the battery technologies here. These are the so-called flow batteries, and what they consist of basically is two tanks and a fuel cell in the middle. And if you want electricity out of them, you just pump the electrolytes. That's what's in these tanks here. And you get electricity. When you want to store electricity, you pump it in the opposite direction. And essentially, it separates again. It's very simple. It's very much like a small chemical factory, if you wish. And there are a number of these types. There is vanadium redox. There is zinc bromine. Other technologies are coming up. Here's an example of a vanadium redox battery. And the picture is a little bit sad because the company has since gone out of existence. They have just missed the coming prosperity for energy storage devices. And this is in Castle Rock, Utah. Again, one of those situations where the load is very far away from the generation, and there is a 209-mile feeder. Again, I bet you have some of those in Minnesota. And they didn't want to upgrade this entire distribution feeder because it means it would take 3 years, and they would have to, and it's expensive. So instead, they chose to do it by storage. And here are the tanks that are being put in, and this is the fuel cell for it. And this thing has been working for 5 years unmanned. In other words, it does the job. Nobody has to fix it, adjust it, and so on. It's a real success in this story. And it's half a megawatt, 500 kilowatt, and they have 2 hours worth of thing. It takes care of the peak period in the village of Castle Rock in Utah. Okay, we can do this bigger too. Here is, in fact, the first application of sodium sulfur battery in the United States at a substation. And what it is, it's a substation. And this substation, the demand was slowly growing over the capacity of the substation. So your choice is you can either pass it on to the customers and have rolling brownouts or whatever it is. You just say, well, when it's really hot, we won't give you any electricity. Or you can build a new one. That'll take you 3 years. And you're not just going to upgrade it that little bit, you're going to upgrade it a lot so that you're really building for 10 years from now. The other option was to introduce a storage unit. And this is the substation. Over in the right corner, you see the sodium sulfur battery, and then there's power conditioning system and electronics and stuff like this. And again, it works like a charm. The red curve there is what the substation would be, what the throughput would be. The blue is what actually happened because the difference is being made up by the storage. I was there at the inauguration. In fact, we did this together with AEP, American Electric Power, because we have a lot of experience working with Sandia National Laboratory, and so we funded part of the project, and we also did the monitoring, and eventually do the analysis of the thing. It's a joint project. And this is 1.2 megawatt for 6 hours. Okay, can cover the entire daytime thing. And the economics is interesting because the economics isn't had from the difference in day and night differential. See, there, electricity is obviously cheaper at night and more expensive during the daytime. But that wasn't the economics. The economics comes from the fact that you can defer building a new station by 3 years. They were originally planning for 5 years. They decided after 3 years that they have proven their point. They are now taking the entire station and they are trucking it to another substation. And they get the same profits all over again. So this deferral of an upgrade produces an economically very viable situation. Now, for us, these things are all important because they're all firsts. You know, we are not really in the business of constructing a lot of examples. You know, we are particularly interested in the first one, two, or three. Show that the technology can work and document it carefully. Now, here's the same sodium sulfur battery, but this time it's on the customer side of the meter. This is a bus refueling station, and they used to run all night, and that was inconvenient. Now they put in these 1 megawatt of sodium sulfur. They store the electricity at night automatically, doesn't need anybody to stand by and throw switches or whatever it is. And then during the daytime, it fuels these compressors, which produce natural gas for this fleet of 220 buses. And it takes away the peaks that otherwise would have been borne by the local utility company. I'm particularly proud of having been involved in that one. That was a New York State IRDA DOE project. New York State is the NYSERDA is the energy office of New York State. Okay, and they have a reasonable research budget and so on. Because we involved a lot of different utilities in that. There are utilities all the way up in, from down in southern United States up to Quebec participating in it. We just finally commissioned it. This went through a lot of glitches, and most of the glitches were the interconnect. Interconnecting a new technology can be a very knotty problem. And again, it's one where conceivably state legislatures can help because it can pave the way and they can suggest that interconnection be facilitated for new technologies, obviously provided they can show that they can do it properly. There are several similar projects like this coming up. AEP is going to do three more projects. In fact, they were so pleased with the success of their one project that they immediately put in three new projects, and they are planning to have 20 megawatts by the end of the decade and 1,000 megawatts by the end of the decade after that. PG&E has 6 megawatts of sodium sulfur actually just sitting there. They are having problems with their Public Utility Commission about how the tariff is going to be. Is it generation? Is it load? Because it's both of those things. There are naughty problems there, and it will need a lot of thinking through in order to enable these technologies. Duke is doing the same thing, but with a zinc bromine technology. It's a flow battery. And Delhi Co-op, small co-op in the wilderness of New York, upper New York, does the same thing, smaller, 500 kilowatt. So it doesn't just take huge utilities. Co-ops can do it too. In fact, I like working with co-ops because generally they can decide on things much faster than these big monster utilities. Okay, next subject. Renewables dispatch smoothing, ramping, and peak shifting. As we all know, the states have pretty aggressive renewable standards. 20%. Minnesota, I believe, has 25%. And they have separate, and Xcel is 30%, I think. They're even tougher. You also have a separate standard for greenhouse gas emission as such. So, we've got fairly ambitious sort of standards. And, of course, we've got, even though the United States hasn't signed it, the Kyoto Protocol as a moral influence is there, and it's something that the rest of the world is very much aware of, and so are we, even if we didn't sign. Now, the trouble is, mandates of that type are a problem for the grid to absorb. Now, there are those who say the grid can take care of it. I won't argue with them because they're speaking from the heart because they really want to see renewables succeed. But at the same time, these renewables, because they go on and off and because the wind tends to blow when you don't want it to blow, or at least when the load isn't there, they do have problems. And it means that there has to be standby fossil fuel generation because something has to even this out. Okay, so you either have to stand by fossil fuel or you can do the same job with sizable energy storage deployment. Okay, but you need something in there as a buffer. And, I'm talking tongue-in-cheek now. You've got to be very careful when you talk in the renewable space. We used to call it intermittent. That's not politically acceptable anymore. And we called it variable. And I think the current word is flexible. So you've got to be very careful. Now, the other problem, and that's a more serious problem, is how you put it. Do you say smoothing and ramping backup is required for renewables, or do you say it's necessary for grid stability? You see the difference in the semantics? On the one hand, you're saying, don't do renewables unless you've got storage. And that's a way one can take it. Japan, for example, is doing it. They're telling, don't put any renewables on unless you've got storage for the backup. But you can also say, and it's certainly a fully valid point, to say, look, the grid needs something. It has input from the load, input from the generation. It needs something to stabilize it, and this is where storage plays. So one has to be careful one doesn't get into fist fights about these things. Happened to me. Here are three of the problems with... I've got to be careful, and correct me if I make a mistake. It's not there are problems with renewables. There are grid problems with renewable input. One of them is the quick fluctuations. Okay, this is an actually measured voltage on a line that comes out of a wind farm in vulnerable power territory. Okay, I mean, this is awful if you happen to be on that line. Really, you really got to do something. However, it's not that bad, because this is basically just regulation. And we just said regulation can be handled by storage quite easily. Okay? The next thing is ramps. Ramps are when the wind, for reasons of its own, dies down or ramps up over a very considerable amount during a fairly short period of time. So a ramp can happen in half an hour, an hour, and the utility then has to pull up backup reserves and so on, or import it from other states in order to make up this deficit. And it's a real problem. And finally, the thing is, in many states like California and Texas, the wind is anti-correlated. It blows at night when the load is smallest, and during the daytime it's lowest. Okay, I mean, these are realities that one has to grapple with. As we mentioned, variable renewable generation is going to increase the need for regulation. Regulation can be taken care of, no problem. But if you, for instance, do the 20% renewables, which California expects by 2012, you're going to have something between 47 and 138% increase in regulation. Now, we've got to prepare for that. If we put the renewables on, we've got to have more regulation. Again, my preference would be doing it by storage. Now, again, it doesn't matter whether the fluctuations come from the load or generation. They still need regulation, and that can be provided most efficiently by storage. A quick example, earlier last year, the wind power dropped 1,200 megawatts in 10 minutes. Now, they avoided a blackout because they immediately had voluntary dropping of load from many of the from participating industries. It's also to some degree their fault, because the prediction was there that the wind would be dying down, and they didn't listen to that. But the main thing is, this kind of thing has happened, and it will happen. And it will happen increasingly the more penetration of renewables we have. And that one, by the way, was felt as far away as Manitoba in Canada. I mean, there were fluctuations all over the grid. Not serious ones, but they were noticeable. Okay, so we have these things. I don't think we can do anything. Freedom of speech. After this nice defense of storage as a solution to renewables, I wish I could show you lots and lots of good examples. Okay, unfortunately, I can't as yet. Ask me back again next year. But we do have a heartwarming example here in the jungles of Peru. They have a generator, and they've got solar. And with our participation, they now have batteries. And basically, the batteries allow the generator and the solar to be input in a well-balanced way. And what they do is they run instead of having the generator follow the load, the generator runs flat for a certain period of time, charges up the battery, and then the battery accepts solar power and covers the load as required. Here's another example. In general, when you do this, when you throw in storage along with diesel generators and renewables, you decrease the amount of fuel by about 20%. Now, remember, one-third of the world is off-grid and probably will stay that way forever. This is a good paradigm for off-grid generation. Okay, we do, however, have projects starting. Here is one, a NYSERDA sort of DUE project. It's at a university campus, and they're going to install solar. And their game plan is they're going to put in 150 kilowatts two-hour storage and 100 kilowatt of solar. The point there is not to simply provide solar power off-peak. The point there is to throw everything into two peak hours in New York City, because New York City is way overloaded during peak hours. So any contribution you can make during peak hours is much more valuable than giving it at any off time. So at peak hour, with 100 kilowatt and 150 kilowatt storage, they could potentially provide 250 kilowatts of peaking power. And this is part of the Solar Cities U.S. program, so they get all kinds of tax rebates and so on to make this thing feasible. It's in the works. Again, another couple of months, I'll be able to show the batteries in place and the solar panels. And now I have something pleasant to relate, and this is Minnesota. Xcel has put in a 1 megawatt, 6-hour sodium sulfur facility in Luverne, Minnesota, to complement their 11 megawatt wind. And it's supposed to be ready in April, and it's perfect because this is right here, right now. So Minnesota is already one of the pioneers in energy storage. And one should remember that there are about 1,000 megawatts of wind in play in this area. And by 2020, we can expect something like 3,000 megawatts. And as the amount of wind grows, any amount of storage is going to help towards making the grid more stable and making the grid accept the whatever wind power or solar power the renewable developers can manage to produce. So, very lovely thing. Now, again, the Japanese have been there before, and they have built a 34 megawatt storage unit, same technology, sodium sulfur, and this is to back up a 51 megawatt wind farm. And their game plan is to put all of the wind at night into their battery, zero output, all goes into the battery, and then in the daytime, they can have fully dispatchable energy. Okay, they can dispatch it at whatever level, and this interacts with predictions in wind, predictions in load, and so on, so that it works just like a power plant. And I think it's already completed, Ed. Yeah, it's completed. We haven't really had much in the way of reports on how well it works, but I have every confidence that it works very well. If you want to go even bigger, then you have to go to... The point is you can go bigger. I mean, you can go to 100 megawatts, and Ed will tell you about projects to do 100 megawatt battery facilities. Entirely doable. However, another technology that conceivably goes even beyond that is compressed air energy storage. And what you do in compressed air energy storage basically is you take inexpensive off-peak power and you compress air and store the compressed air in an aquifer, in a salt dome, or in a mined cavern. Okay? And salt domes exist all over the place. It's an easy technology. You just leach out a big cavern, and that goes in there. You can use depleted oil wells. You can use an aquifer underground, just like the aquifers that we used when we were storing thermal energy here in Minnesota. And on peak, when you need the energy, you use this compressed air essentially to feed into the compressor of a gas turbine. Right? It eliminates the need for the compressor because the air is already compressed, and your gas turbine, although it does consume gas, will do so much more efficiently than it would do otherwise. So basically, you're scooting the energy from the off-peak over to on-peak. There are two of those in existence in the world, which is sort of embarrassing, because we call it a mature technology because it works so well. But yet, there are only two examples. At the moment, there's a lot of interest in having more of those. And if you notice, by the way, these are fairly sizable. These are like 290 megawatt and 110 megawatt. So, I mean, these are substantial units. They are basically power plants. Here's a project we have in Iowa with the municipal utilities in Iowa. We want to do 268 megawatt compressed air energy storage in an aquifer. Basically, that means there is a porous sandstone way down there, and it contains water, and you pump air down, and it makes a big bubble. When you need it, the pressure makes the bubble contract again, and that's your compressed air. Again, I like working with small utilities because they can respond faster. There are several other of these case projects underway. Last thing I just, before I left, I had an email of one of the compressed air energy storage companies wanting to come in and talk about their development. In fact, it was the PSEG folks, but NYSEG is planning one up in New York State. EPRI has a number of them that they're interested in. We will probably see two or three of those in the next decade or so. So, conclusion. Energy storage can provide power quality and digital reliability. It can provide voltage and frequency regulation and smooth renewable contributions. It can allow better asset utilization of generation and transmission. And it can provide spinning reserve and energy management to accommodate renewable resources. And that's the world as we see it. Okay? You can stick storage any place you possible. You know, you can have it on the consumer side. You can have it on the in a transmission substation. You can have it interact with wind. It can be your plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. It can protect factories. It's interesting. You get different people, and they have an entire different way they see the world. Well, us storage folks see the world that way. Distributed storage, distributed generation, and distributed intelligence. The distributed intelligence is smart grid. Now, one caveat. Energy storage changes things. Once we have adopted energy storage widely, it's going to change the whole electricity business. Because suddenly, it's not no longer this hand-to-mouth thing. You know, the electricity business is run much the way hunter-gatherers go around. You know, our forebears used to go around and, you know, they found something they stuck in their mouth. You know, or maybe they could save it for in their pouch to bring home. But it was hand-to-mouth. I mean, you hunt it, you gather it, you consume it. What did they do? They invented the pot. And once they invented the clay pot, they could now store grain or whatever it is for long periods of time. Energy storage is the pot. Okay. Once we have efficient energy storage, we can have a much more rational distribution of electricity. We can have a better price structure because we don't have to work with these spikes and so on. And that's basically it. A few resources of where you can find things. There are websites. Sandia.gov is one of them. That's our website. The Electricity Storage Organization has an excellent website. There's a fact thing called the EPRI DU Energy Storage Handbook, which is available on the net. So you know, if you can download it. And there's an Electricity Storage Association meeting coming up in May, and an international storage meeting that DOE runs together with the ESA in Seattle. Now, Ed Cazalet is going to talk next and present you with some more storage. And then we are going to discuss of what could one do to further the cause of storage.
Thank you. My name is Ed Cazalet. I'm with Megawatt Storage Farms, which is we're not a government agency. We're on the private sector side. So we would build storage facilities for use by utilities, for use by co-ops, for use by whoever, or perhaps for our own use in terms of providing services on the grid. So we buy storage technologies. We don't. We'll operate with any storage technology that is commercial, economic, and ready to go, and do the financing and deployment of that technology.
Dr. Cazalet, your company doesn't specialize then in a specific kind of storage, is that correct?
No. My own background, I'm 40 years in the power industry. Till recently, I was on the Board of Governors, the California Independent System Operator, appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger. Prior to that, I have a number of other startup businesses in the electric power industry. And as I said, Megawatt develops and operates storage farms. So we go through the planning process for our clients, the development process from financing to deployment to testing, and then can operate it 24/7. Operating storage is a little different than operating something else because the batteries aren't quite the same as the power plant. Decide when to charge, when to discharge, and worry about the management of the temperature of the battery and that sort of thing to maximize its life. As Emery mentioned, there are a number of alternative storage technologies that are various states of commercial development. Pump hydro is the one where you have two reservoirs and pump water from the lower reservoir up to the upper reservoir, consuming electricity when you want to, say, in the middle of the night or when the wind is blowing. And then once the reservoir is full, you can run the water downhill and generate power when you need it. Compressed air storage does a similar thing by compressing air and putting it underground. Next is the sodium-sulfur battery, which I'll talk about more in a minute. Flow battery, which Emery just went through, where it's basically you think of it as a battery cell, and you have these tanks of electrolyte. You make the tanks as big as you want to store as much electricity as you want, then you flow them through a cell that's got a given power. Lithium ion batteries, the same batteries that are used in your laptops, are typically being deployed in these trailers that will produce 2 megawatts for perhaps 15 minutes. Primary application of those is for frequency regulation that Emery just mentioned. Flywheels, the same application. Again, Megawatt works with any of these storage technologies. Now, Emery mentioned this. One of the things Emery mentioned, I want to emphasize, is the scale of the need. It's not kilowatts. It's not milliwatts like in your laptops and so on. It's not even megawatts, it's gigawatts of need here. And so you have to get ready to deal with that kind of problem. And with the rapid increase in the amount of renewables on the grid and the greenhouse gas requirements, you may have a target a decade now or 2 decades from now where you're going to need this in very large quantities. You have to start now to build that capability and satisfy that need and also create the opportunities for your local industries. So this is the picture of this 34 megawatt battery farm in northern Japan at a 50-megawatt wind farm, already deployed and already operating. Each of those boxes is full of batteries that last, provide 2 megawatts for 7 hours. Okay, a megawatt will serve a very large Walmart or something like that. Let's give you an example of the size. Now, that's deployed at a wind farm. And the reason it's deployed at a wind farm in Japan is they have the rule that you, as Emery said, you must smooth the wind before you put it on the grid. That's just the way they set it up. Under the Kyoto Treaty, they're building a lot of these wind farms around Japan for 2012. The Japanese government subsidizes the batteries, pays 30% of the cost. Based on that subsidy and the requirement, the wind farms put this in and cover the rest of the revenues in the market. We have a different situation in the U.S. Wind farms aren't required to smooth the wind before they put it on the grid. They let the grid operator, the utility, smooth the wind. Actually, I think that's the start of a better way of doing it because it's more efficient. This is another example of how those same batteries are deployed differently. Instead of being at the wind farm, you put them in the cities. I call this a renewables storage park. This is an example of one that's been operating. Japan's way ahead of us in storage. Operating at Hitachi in Japan. Provides 8 megawatts of capability, again, 7 hours storage of eight megawatts. You know, you can walk up. I've been to this sort of thing. I can open the cabinet and touch the batteries. They're warm, very safe. They deploy them next to schools. They're allowed to put them in buildings in Japan. They're certified for transport on the highways, that sort of thing. It's a clean, no noise, no emissions, no water requirements. Not too bad looking for a substation or industrial area. You can deploy these anywhere you want, 1 megawatt at a time, 10 megawatts, 50 megawatts, where you need it on the grid for a variety of applications. This is just an example of one of the technologies. So we've been looking a lot at California and its challenges. And we have a 20% renewables target for 2012 and a 33% renewables target for 2020. All this is tied into the greenhouse gas regulations that Governor Schwarzenegger and the legislature have passed. We 33% renewables targets for the electric industry is a key part of meeting the greenhouse gas targets, which are aggressive for California. And so there's a whole lot of across the state of California, a whole lot of renewables going in. Some of them are easy to work with, like geothermal. There's a lot of solar PV going in, some of it in the desert, but a lot of it going in the city. In L.A., they're putting in 250 megawatts of solar PV on industrial rooftops. A similar program is about to be announced by PG&E in Northern California. And then we have some very substantial wind projects, particularly in this general area, where there'll be thousands of megawatts of wind added over the next decade or so. Some of that wind is situated in a place where the wind comes through a pass up over and through the wind turbines. Wind can be howling. Right after that, the wind decides to, wind shear go over top of the turbines. All that power disappears. Thousands of megawatts in minutes. We have to be prepared to stand by to take care of that change. And that will often happen in the middle of the morning ramp when the power generation is going up. The only alternative to storage is to keep fossil fuel units built, often running 24/7, spewing out emissions. And operating at very efficient levels from a fuel and emissions point of view. The alternative is storage. So what we're proposing, and it's being reviewed, is thinking in terms of, for 2020, for the 33% renewable, a gigawatt, that's 1,000 megawatts. That'd be 500 of those 200 megawatt batteries if it was sodium sulfur or some other technology. In the Bay Area, you get about 50 megawatts on an acre. So it's not a large amount of land required for that kind of power. 2 gigawatts in the L.A. Basin and 1 gigawatt in the San Diego Basin, just roughly. And with that, that would be about 5% of California's peak. Okay. So our reserve margin is typically 15%. This is 5%, actually a fairly modest requirement. There'd be no emissions, no water, no noise from this. Now, the key thing is, the San Francisco Bay Area, we can't build any new fossil plants anyway. Every time somebody proposes a new fossil plant and it gets approved, it never gets built. They can't build any new transmission lines. So the only real alternative in the Bay Area now is distributed generation. Most of the mayors around there, the local communities, want to go completely green. So, you know, this fits in with that trend, and putting that storage, which we need for modulating, managing the wind, managing the solar, close to the load, provides local reliability, saves building all that transmission, saves the loss of importing that power, the highest loads when the transmission lines are most heavily loaded, and provides a local source that is completely clean. Fits in with any local renewables, such as all the PV, photovoltaic generation they're planning in that area. So that would say, so the benefits of it is displaces about 4 gigawatts of transmission and distribution investment. You saw what AEP, that was a primary benefit of their sodium sulfur deployment. It provides 4 gigawatts of, they call it RA capacity, resource adequacy. Public Utilities Commission requires that utilities plan for 115% of the peak demand, and they have capacity under contract to provide that, and they make payments for that capacity. So this provides 4 gigawatts of capacity. Now, the neat thing about batteries, for that 4 gigawatts, you get really 8 gigawatts of dispatchable range, because it can both charge 4 gigawatts and discharge at 4 gigawatts. So if you're trying to handle volatility of the wind and that sort of thing, I'll get to this in a minute, it provides 8 gigawatts of swing capacity. Very helpful for dealing with wind. Part of that is, in the middle of the night, we have a problem in California when the wind's blowing, there's not enough load, too much generation operating at minimum levels, we have to throw away wind power in the middle of the night, even today. 10 years from now, it's several times that amount of wind, we have to throw away more. So this can absorb that and grit in the night. Voltage support, like end of these long lines or neighborhoods where the voltage drops because the load can't be carried by the transmission lines, provides that kind of support if you locate the batteries in the right place. Again, you can locate 1 megawatt at a time or 50 megawatts, depending on how you want to deploy it across the neighborhoods. Now, the problem we have is the utilities are still thinking big gas turbines, big combined cycle units. So they issue requests for proposals looking out 5 years, and they say, we can't rely on the wind, so for every gigawatt of wind we buy, we've got to buy 1 gigawatt of thermal to back it up, fossil fuel plants. They don't have storage in their planning process. They've got a few test cases, but they're not thinking far enough ahead. Key thing is to get them in their procurement processes, begin to think ahead, what's this, our system going to look like in 2020, 2030? Do we want more of the same, or do we want storage to be a proper part of that mix? Now, let me just, there's the cost of storage and the benefit of storage. Cost is different by technology, and I can address that in a second. Let me just highlight the benefits of storage. If I've got 1 gigawatt of nameplate of capacity from storage there, or gigawatt, it's 1,000 megawatts of capacity from generation, what do I get? Well, for storage, I get 2 gigawatts of dispatchable range. If I'm putting this technology on the grid to take up volatility of wind and load and smooth things out. It's the dispatchable range that's important, not just the size of it, the generation. So I get twice, it's worth twice as much as fossil fuel because of that. And as you look more closely, I can only move that fossil fuel generation back and forth if it's up and running. Generally, it's got to be running at 50 or 60% of its peak, so I really only get about a half that in terms of dispatchable range. So that means at that point, storage is four times better than fossil fuel in providing dispatchability. Then, as Emery mentioned, storage is much faster in responding than fossil fuel. Fossil fuel can take minutes or tens of minutes sometimes to respond to the signal the system operator sends out to balance the grid. So that gives you about, and you know, they say it's worth about twice as much. So it says storage is about 2 × 2 × 2, 8 times more effective in providing dispatchability to the grid than is a fossil fuel unit. So you can afford to pay 8 times as much. Perhaps it actually costs twice as much. It's the benefits exceed the cost. Now, and the reality is, if you look at San Francisco Bay Area, and perhaps you've got areas in Minnesota, the same thing, people won't let you build any more fossil fuel close to the load where you really need it. So you've got to build transmission. They won't let you build the transmission. And so there really is no alternative other than storage in many cases. So the competition is not so much storage versus fossil fuel plants, but which type of storage is the best for the situation least costly and most reliable. And that's the direction I see it going. Now, I haven't studied the policy framework here, nor exactly the needs for storage. I mean, you could think of a study to look at what are the best places to put storage in Minnesota, how much, where, when, what is the need, and then directing the utilities to move that direction. In California, there's a lot of activity going on in storage right now. First is to adjust the California Independent System Operator market so they more fully utilize the storage, send out the faster signals. And that work is ongoing, just as it is at the Midwest ISO. The second thing is we have procurement policies in California, something called loading orders. First requires utilities to buy energy efficiency. Then it requires them to buy demand response resources. Then renewable resources, and finally fossil fuel resources. When they wrote that procurement law, didn't think about storage. It's not in there. And so we're asking that they clarify that procurement order and put storage on the same level as the demand side management and response resources, because they're really a very similar item. So it'd be behind energy efficiency, but ahead of renewables and ahead of fossil fuel plants. Third item is, how do we get the utilities to begin to rethink their planning process? You have a renewable portfolio standard in Minnesota, so do we. You can think in terms of a storage portfolio standard that would direct utilities what the percentage should be and when it should be at various percentages would be something to think. You could direct the utilities in the procurement processes to buy or contract for storage equal to, say, in California, we think the right number is about 5% of peak, 2020, buy storage that is clean, fast, and deep. Now, clean means there's no greenhouse gas emissions. Fast, it can respond in a second, or most of the storage can respond even more quickly than that. And deep, with 4 to 6 hours of storage. Now, there's also a need for batteries and flywheels with less storage, and perhaps that might be a need of about 1%. Okay, because the short-term batteries can't handle the ramping load when the wind drops off quickly over a period of an hour or two and doesn't need time to spin up any backup generation or provide the power in the interim. That type of storage is only good for frequency leveling and not deeper responses. So there may be a secondary requirement for short-term storage. Now, in some cases, as we found out, just a portfolio standard isn't enough. It's helpful to have a feed-in tariff. Feed-in tariffs have worked very well for renewables in Europe. What a feed-in tariff would require is would require the utilities to offer to buy storage services at a given price level. And then storage, just different storage technology providers would compete to beat that price level. But that would be an incentive to move it forward. And all that cost would, of course, be passed on to the customers. The studies would have to show that the customers are benefiting because they're getting a technology in there that is lower cost than the existing fossil fuel systems, and at the same time is providing environmental benefits and facilitating the introduction of more renewables on the grid than it otherwise carried reliably and cost-effectively on the grid. And finally, as Emery mentioned, there are a set of state and federal regulatory policies that need to be worked on. I'm not sure what the policy is in here, but there's a federal policy that storage cannot be owned by a transmission entity, also bid into the Midwest ISO markets, for example, because they don't want transmission entities competing with the generators in the energy markets. Similar thing in California. Another issue of if you're a distribution utility, can you buy storage and compete with other people on the grid to provide energy services? All of this is created by the fact we've taken our vertically integrated utilities and broken them up into generating companies, transmission companies, distribution companies, and so-called load-serving entities, those people who actually serve customers. And we're allowing competition. In some cases, there are competing generating companies. This has allowed the wind industry to develop, the independent solar industry. Affiliated generating companies owned by utilities still can compete in that, but they're on a relatively level playing field. We suggest storage be treated the same way. You need to put it on the same playing field, so if utility-owned storage and independently-owned storage, and co-op-owned storage, and all that sort of thing can all operate competitively in the Midwest ISO markets. So those, I can answer questions in more detail on any of that. But I'm Emery and I are open for questions at this point in time. We really appreciate the opportunity to meet you and speak with you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Gallet. You know, maybe if both of you would have a seat at the table, we could, or if you want to come down a little closer here, that would be fine, too, and just have kind of an informal conversation here. You know, some of your information, Dr. Cazalet, is new to me. You know, I'm not sure how the mechanics of that would work. I mean, here in Minnesota, we just went through a piece that separated the transmission industry from the generation portion, and you know, you're talking about several different pieces there, I guess, and I'm just wondering, you know, what actually brought that about, or what was the impetus that drove that division?
The division? Well, this has been the idea of dividing, separating transmission from generation, is to allow competition on the generation side to have equal access to the transmission. Because independent providers of generation used to complain that if they built a power plant and tried to connect it up to the utility's transmission line, and that utility also owned generation, that they weren't getting a fair access to the grid, and therefore...
Sure, yeah.
And so in order to encourage competition in generation, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in some states have moved that direction.
Similar to the unbundling of the telephone network into transmission, basically, and then the local providers and the overall providers.
So, in your opinion, then, deregulation has worked to the advantage of the public?
Well,
either one of you.
It was designed to work to the advantage of the public. Particularly as a federal employee, I can't very well tell you what I think about it. But the point is, it obviously has positive and perhaps less comfortable aspects. And one of them is that it makes it very difficult to... storage is not an animal that easily fits into that framework, because it has some of the characteristics of generation, of load and transmission and distribution. So it needs to be resolved. I mean, we know it's good, but we need to be able to fit it into the family.
Okay. Yeah, you know, it does seem to me that there's a growing number of people in Minnesota, you know. Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, I look at what wind developers are getting paid on their power purchase agreements, and then I look at what the utility charges to the public, and they're getting charged a higher rate, when it seems to me that, you know, the power that the utility is receiving is actually less than the other power that they generate, and I'm just not sure how those pieces fit together. I mean, why is it coming to the consumer at a higher rate when that's not true on the other end of the spectrum, or at least that's the way it appears to me?
Well, it's, you know, I'd be happy to make a general comment about that, because I know nothing about the specifics of Minnesota. But, you know, across the country, in general, and I'm not sure about that, you have two types of load-serving entity: those that remain regulated and those that are competitive. And the load-serving entities, they're cost-based. In other words, whatever the wind costs them, they pass that on to their rate base. Of course, they're adding costs for distribution. They're adding their own costs. They may have costs of nuclear plants or coal plants that are embedded in their rates. So there's obviously a regulatory process to balance that out.
That maybe appears to me that would be true up to a point, but they also get a federal credit for that renewable form that brings the cost way below, you know, the other forms of generation. So I don't know. I guess that's kind of a bewilderment to me, maybe. But.
Well, again, that's something you have a Public Utilities Commission, right?
Yeah.
And they would be responsible for determining if those rates charged are fair. And something I can't comment on.
Okay. You know, before, too, Dr. Guk, when you were talking, you know, I guess, you know, I mean, I think both of you could probably answer that, but would the various forms of storage all be dependent then on location, or is there one that is used more predominantly than others, or... You know, do you have an opinion as to which one might work better in Minnesota? And it would depend on, I mean, we've got rivers on both sides of the state that might be, you know, amenable to doing the hydro piece, but, you know, in other parts of the state that might be a problem most of the time.
Yeah, I would think... I have a feeling Minnesota is relatively flat. I mean, do you have sizable mountain ranges? I don't think so.
Whenever only I'm hiking, on some I'm television
very
programs
happy that
I claim
didn't
to
have
be
to go up and down.
Yeah, it's difficult to find pumped hydro sites.
Yeah.
Often, when you do, there's a lot of local opposition, because if there's a lake involved, they don't like to see the lake going up and down substantially every day. So that in California, the lead time for proposed new pumped hydro projects is in the order of 14 years.
Okay.
And if you're talking about 2020 or 2025, that's a long lead time. So it's really not an effective option for meeting Californians' needs. And we've got more geography, that would support pumped hydro than probably Minnesota has.
Yeah, well, it seems to me in Minnesota you'd almost, and it would depend on how much fall you needed to generate the capacity that you wanted, but, you know, you'd almost have to build something that created that fall, and I don't know if that would be economically viable or not, but, you know, it's, like I say, you know, only in programs like Little House on the Prairie where they talk about the mountains north of Walnut Grove, but the people that live there, you know, wonder where that mountain range is, you know. It's, they haven't been able to spot it in 50 years of living there, you know. But you know, I guess I was wondering, too, you know, if 5%, you know, Dr. Gick, you mentioned that 5% of storage could help you reduce 25% of your peak load. You know, that seems like it would have a huge impact on cost of storage.
Well, and part of the problem with storage is that, you know, before it is really widely deployed, the cost is relatively high, and the degree of deployment is going to bring the cost down, as with any other technology.
But there are places, some places on the grid where the benefits are much higher. You deploy it there first. You deploy the technology that is commercial, and that will develop manufacturing and lower costs either here or in other places and enable the further development. But I believe storage today in many applications is already economic. The barriers are simply the procurement process and imagination.
Yeah. You know, I guess just out of curiosity, what turns the flywheel?
The it's basically an induction motor, which means it's you put electricity in. There is a generator essentially sitting, a motor generator sitting inside the flywheel, and the windings of the input current essentially gets that motor going. And then when you want to extract energy, then basically you slow down the flywheel and the difference comes out as electricity again.
So you use a motor to spin it up, and that same motor becomes a generator when you want to take it out. And this goes at very, very high speeds. It's very heavy and at very high speed, so it can store a lot of kinetic energy.
Yeah, I assumed it would have to be at high speeds, but well, there's a lot there.
You, Senator, you had mentioned earlier when we talked that you would have liked to see some examples of what other states have done in terms of facilitating storage. Mm-hmm. And I have a small list there. There are not so many of them, but they are growing. The most recent, for example, California established a tax incentive of $2 per watt for storage if it is installed in conjunction with wind or fuel cells as part of the self-generation incentive programs. Now, this is for smaller applications, but it is an opening.
Mm-hmm.
This is a direct incentive. Similarly, in Louisiana, they allow the personal corporate franchise tax credit for solar and wind. And they are stating that the battery backup is takes part in that tax credit. Another one is the Texas solar and wind energy tax deduction. They are creating, they're allowing storage as, again, as part of a wind or solar energy. The point is, if you install, particularly on smaller scale, if you install solar or wind and you install storage at the same time, it really should have the same tax advantages because it makes the whole system work better.
Well, you know, when you mentioned that kind of 1-to-5 ratio that storage can cover, You know, and then with Japan's storage facility at 34 megawatts, it would seem to me that that would cover considerably more than the 51 megawatts that they currently have. So have they built that for future generation as well? Or?
Excellent observation. Their rule, I think, is poor. They require each wind farm to put in enough storage to make that wind farm dispatchable. Whereas a better, the wind industry will argue, well, if the wind farm over here is not blowing, and the one over here is, you know, we look at the two together and you see you need much less storage. So the right way to deploy storage is let all the wind farms put their storage, their generation on the grid, and then let the grid operators say, what resources do I need in order to meet the load? And that's a much smaller amount of storage than if each independent wind farm had to do his own and smooth his own.
Mm-hmm.
You take advantage of the grid. The wind industry is very supportive of that approach, and it's just more economic to the consumers. Japan still has vertically integrated utilities, does not have any kind of the so-called deregulation, so they basically make it tough for wind farmers to come on the grid and compete, something we've avoided through our open access under the deregulation.
So, yeah, sure, go ahead.
I just had a question regarding the storage attributes. You said there are no emissions, no water is used or anything. What's the life of one of these big battery, say that's connected to a wind farm? Or do they get used up? Do you have to put them somewhere? Is there no acid or anything?
The better ones are guaranteed for 20 years.
Okay.
Roughly. And hopefully by that time there'll be a complete program to recycle the components.
So in this country, for lead-acid batteries, like your car batteries, there's a very active recycling program, and you'd expect that to happen for all the batteries. But, you know, when there's just small production, you have to take care of that as your own developer or send it back to the factory and pay them something to do that. But it'll become – all this is recyclable.
Senator Rummel, go ahead.
Excuse me for – having to step out. I can't be in two places at once. And you've probably already covered this, but are these batteries useful for storage when people are setting up solar?
Yes. The challenge for solar is a little different than the challenge for wind. Solar, of course, it's when the sun is shining, it's generally when people are up and performing their normal activities or using air conditioning. So you don't need as much storage. But often, say, in California, the peak load will be in the evening. People come on, turn on their plasma TVs and everything else, and when the sun's not shining, you're not shining very much. So you need enough storage to shift it a few hours, and then the cloud goes behind an area and that sort of thing, and it can drop off. So it's an easier problem to solve, but they are useful for that. And particularly if you have a large area like Los Angeles with a large amount of photovoltaic on it, storage on the distribution grid will be needed, either at the substations or in people's homes.
And the other problem is if a cloud comes over the solar collector, it's a very rapid drop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wind hardly ever drops quite that fast.
So you're saying yes or no?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean... Yeah. Batteries can be used in all of those cases.
And, I mean, there really isn't any good alternative. And many people who put solar in today will put lead-acid batteries if you're off the grid. Or
mm-hmm. So I'll leave a copy of my presentation.
We'll make copies of it and distribute it to the committee, probably to the full committee. But, you know, I guess, you've both looked at these issues in terms of, you know, what we call renewable. Sometimes I wonder if the language is even accurate because what we're doing doesn't seem like it will be sustainable in the long run.
You mean wind and solar, or?
No, depending on fossil fuels kind of thing. You know, it seems to me that there's got to be a limit out there somewhere, and, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, when you look at wind, I think, you know, wind is going to be the same price in terms of generation, you know, over the long haul. The wind is not going to increase in price. You know, certainly the machinery will, but, yeah. You know, does anybody believe that, you know, that coal prices will remain the same for the next 25 years? I mean, basically you're locking in a price when you give a power purchase agreement that covers, that span of time. But, you know, from the perspective of the two of you, could you make some comment on what you see as the future of the solar industry and what might be ways that a state could encourage that portion of the industry to move forward a little more rapidly?
Solar is a contrast to wind?
I'm talking primarily about solar power rather than wind.
There are several types of solar power. There's photocells that we're all familiar with, you put on your roof. There's others which is concentrated. They put essentially a lens on it so you can concentrate it on the cell and get more power, but it's a bulkier system.
Are there any of those in the United States that are operational?
Yes, and there's huge amounts of solar going in California. There's very strong incentives from the federal government and the state to put in solar. Every few weeks, it seems that utilities in California announce another several hundred megawatt project for solar. In fact, solar is projected to grow more quickly than wind in California. Of course, we have some particularly good areas in Southern California for solar resources. So, yeah, I think the costs of solar manufacturing are coming down substantially. They have new technologies. So I think it plays a large role in addition to wind. Both of those are renewable technologies in that we're not going to run out of that source of energy.
Yeah.
As a contrast to the fossil fuel generation based on coal or natural gas primarily. So there's substantial efforts in California and substantial support for that as the only effective way to meet California's greenhouse gas.
Well, do you foresee a time when, I mean, you talked about the drop in the production cost of the PV cells. You know, is there some point in time at which, you know, those cost points will cross and solar will be cheaper than other forms of usage?
It's moving that direction. How fast you get there? You've heard the pronouncement from Google, renewable energy cheaper than coal. So people are working hard to achieve that goal. The improvements in the cost of wind equipment are substantial. The capability, the same for solar. They have thin film manufacturing, tremendous competition. China is investing heavily in both the manufacturing of solar technologies, as well as the use of wind. So it's a global phenomenon. Europe has far more solar than we do in a climate that, you know, is not as good as Southern California, probably comparable to Minnesota's.
And I might mention that even in Minnesota, one of my former students has an energy-independent off-grid home in northern Minnesota, relying on photovoltaic.
Primarily or solely? Is it solely on solar voltaic?
Well, I mean, there's also firewood, of course. But and there's a lot of it in northern Minnesota. But yeah, nonetheless, for running her computer, running the lights, and so on, all of those necessities, she uses photovoltaics entirely. Mm-hmm.
But depending on the politics of greenhouse gas, If you're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, renewables are a big part of that process, and the various types of solar and wind are very effective in doing that. Moving from coal to natural gas can reduce greenhouse emissions. Carbon sequestration can reduce it if we're able to make that economic.
Ever get there?
Yeah. So there's, but in all of those, there's still a need for storage. There's a need for storage on the grid without renewables, and there's a need for storage in the, even more so with large amounts of renewables. In fact, California ISO says at the higher level renewable penetration, storage is essential.
One might mention, incidentally, that should the decision be, for example, to use nuclear power more extensively, you still need storage because nuclear power plants like to produce flat, and then you have to use the storage to fit the load again. So regardless of what source of power you use, storage will still be required.
Most of the pumps, many of the pump storage plants in this country, Tennessee Valley Authority, also in California, were built at the time many of the big nuclear power plants were built, because they want those to run all the time, because they're very heavy investment, but their operating cost is very low, so you don't want to shut them down at night when there's no load. So you store the nuclear power in the pump, in by pumping water uphill, and then let the water run downhill and generate more power during the daytime. So many storage projects, pump storage projects, were developed on the basis of supporting.
Well, I assume that you two have access to more data on you know, the costs of the various forms of power, but how has the storage industry impacted the total cost of power in California as compared to other states?
At this time, not at all.
Well, except for the pumped hydro that's been installed for some time.
Okay.
And that's been very cost-effective for the ratepayers.
Where does California fit in the ranking of states in terms of their power costs, do you know?
It's quite high.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's in part because the two things in California, they banned coal plants for a long time. So that increased, we didn't have access to that low cost. No new nuclear has been built for decades. And so it's heavily dependent on natural gas, the existing hydro plants, and now the renewables. Now, the other side of that, California has been the most aggressive in reducing the growth of electricity through efficiency. So they've the prices are higher, but they've reduced the cost by insulation standards, appliance standards, a large number of things. So,
okay. And the consumption has basically been constant.
So the bills aren't quite as high as you'd otherwise expect if it weren't for the efficiency that have improved.
So do they have, I mean, Minnesota has this thing where utilities are asked to reduce their, you know, to do the conservation thing to the tune of 1.5% annually for so many years. I mean, do other states have something like that?
This has worked very well in California. For the last 10 years, California energy production really hasn't gone up, particularly the per capita consumption.
Okay. Are they still gaining in population?
One way or the other.
Yes.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
That's another issue we probably don't need to cover in this committee.
No, and I would refuse to pontificate in that case.
All right. Well, does any of you have anything you want to contribute, I guess? Well, we sure appreciate your coming out. I guess
sure.
I don't know how close we
pleasure.
Are. We're getting close to the end of our time, too, I guess. So. But appreciate your coming out. And, you know, and Dr. Gyuk, if you could leave your materials with Allie, we'll get it to the other members as well. But, you know, it's nice to have some materials that that you, Anna, you've given us your contact information, so that'll be helpful too if we want to.
Yeah, and if anybody in the audience wants to contact, I think either of us feel free. We'd be happy to.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to make a comment or have something, another piece they'd like to say? I can't see them dying, you know. Okay. It's been primarily an informational hearing, but, you know, we do want to look at ways that we can, you know, move in the direction that I think the people of the state would like to go. So, but thanks to both of you for coming your long distances and joining us here today. We appreciate it a lot. Well, if there aren't any further observations or questions, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.